Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 3:27 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 26th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I do apologize for the late recording. I'm a couple of hours late, and part of the reason for that is because of the troubles we've been having with the chart library, which required some time to try and fix. But the servers have been reconstituted and everything is back in order, at least that is the word that I have from our technicians. So I thought to reiterate, the chart library is now back up and functional. Well, I thought I would kick off this broadcast with a look at the Dow Jones over much of the last 50 years, because what we look at on a logarithmic scale chart, especially over these long-term time frames, gives us a real view of the cycle. And what I find particularly interesting is that the market ranged for the better part of 15 years, from about 1965 through until 1980, and then it broke upwards. And it broke upwards in a very dynamic manner, and it rallied for a couple of years, and then it had perhaps a 1 or 2 year consolidation, and then it took off again. And in that period between when it broke out in 1985 and rallied spectacularly, and we have to consider that the breakout was at approximately 1330, and the 1987 peak was at a high of 2736. Therefore, the market doubled in those couple of years. It was an incredible advance. And then it was, we had a very short, sharp pullback in on Black Friday. Excuse me, on Black Monday. That's that's a Freudian slip if ever I heard one. Now, when the market pulled back very sharply, it went from, let's say, 2,700 and change all the way down to a low of 1600, so it dropped 900 points, which was not a halving, but it wasn't that far off it either. Now, when we look at what's happened recently, well, the market pretty much ranged for the better part of 12 years. Then it broke out and it rallied in a pretty spectacular manner. It went from approximately 13,000 up to a peak of about 18,000, tacked on an additional 5,000 points, and went sideways for a couple of years, and then we've had this explosive breakout. And this explosive breakout is still in evidence. Now, what I find interesting is that we have some storied investors. People like Howard Marks, Jeff Gundlach, and the person who's in charge of Baupost, I can't... his name is escaping me at the moment, but Seth Klarman, they are coming out and saying, well, guys, this market is getting overvalued. This is clearly an acceleration. We are late in the cycle. And what we can say without any equivocation is that those prognostications are correct. But the reality is that this is an accelerating market, and as long as it is accelerating higher, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. What we also have to be aware of, though, is that eventually this acceleration is going to end, and when it ends, it is probably going to do so in a dynamic manner. Now, what is particularly interesting is that the volatility index has been so very low. And what that tends to do is to lull people into a false sense of security. There is a growing belief that volatility will be low indefinitely, that we have, in many respects, conquered the business cycle, conquered volatility, that the incredible amount of liquidity that has flooded the system, and the chase for yield that has been going on now for years has contributed to this short volatility trade being one of the most profitable in any sector for the last few years, with perhaps the possible exception of cryptocurrencies. Well, as long as volatility remains low, then I don't think anyone is going to be particularly worried. But the problem is, and the reason I say that it lulls people into a false sense of security is because of the way that it is calculated. The longer that volatility stays low for, the greater the likelihood is that it is going to spike in a dynamic manner when we do get a pullback. And that's important because when you look at all of the different strategies that have been employed to benefit from momentum. So, ETF buying is essentially momentum investing because the vast majority of indices are market cap weighted, and all of the largest of the ETFs are market cap weighted. And because the largest cap companies have been doing spectacularly well, not only have they helped to influence the performance of their respective indices, but what they are also doing is dominating those indices at, I think, to a greater extent, and that is happening particularly with shares like Amazon, which is clearly accelerating higher. And then you also have Alphabet. So when we look at, for example, Google, Google has been trending in a consistent manner for years. If we look at Google since 2008, and think about it in these terms, it was one of those shares, there's quite a small number of them, that bottomed in 2008 rather than 2009. And it has gone up in a staircase step sequence uptrend. And if I look at that on a logarithmic scale chart, then those steps just jump out. So if we look at it on a decade-long basis, then we get these ranges one above another, and that each of the pullbacks is relatively similar sized, and then it seems to go up in increments of $100. Well, the last one of those increments was around 1,000, and then we had another little range, and the next one then, the next pause we should anticipate from Google is at 1,200. And as long as it is putting in that staircase step sequence uptrend and marching higher in $100 increments, then how complacent are the longs going to be? There is nobody going to be worried about Google as long as the share is marching higher in a step sequence uptrend in $100 increments. It's also a very easy share to analyze because if Google accelerates out of this staircase step sequence uptrend, well, then we'll know that we're close to an ending for it. But then, of course, we also have to remember that the accelerations are usually the time when we make money fastest, and it is at the end of the acceleration that we need to be disciplined about stops. Now, I think that it is worth considering what to do with stops in this kind of situation, because personally, I don't use stops. I don't use them because I fear and I feel like I have enough of a trading experience at this stage to understand that when I have stops in the market, they become targets, and they become targets for algorithmic traders. I have often seen that it comes even for a stop that is wide of the price that has been placed with due care to the volatility that is evident within the chart pattern, I still tend to see them getting triggered. So I place mental stops. I tend to figure out where it is that something would look wrong, and then decide to myself that if it does that, well, then I'm going to get out. So I think that that is something that is worth considering at this stage. Now, we also know that the more that we get accelerations on the upside, the greater the likelihood is that we're going to have a reversion back towards the mean. And when we look at the mean is for Google, for example, is at $1,000, and the price is at 1,200. So it could pull back by about 20% and still be in the region of the trend mean, and it has found support in the region of the trend mean on successive occasions. And Facebook is a very similar example. And it has been marching higher in a rivetingly consistent manner since 2013. And one could say that the pace of the advance is picking up because it hasn't quite closed its overextension relative to the trend mean since the beginning of 2017. But if we are going to argue that, then the pickup in the pace of the advance has so far been moderate. and there is ample potential for it to accelerate higher from here as well. If we are, and I think we are in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market, and that cyclical bull market began in 2009, followed the peak in markets that we had in 2007 and 2008. And one of the reasons that it has been so lengthy, and that this is one of the longest expansions in history for the US economy, is because of the quantity of liquidity that has been thrown at the market. I think that when we differentiate between cyclical and secular bull markets, there is a very clear delineation. In many respects, a cyclical bull market is driven by liquidity. And because central banks raise interest rates and take away the punch bowl and then lower interest rates and bring the punch bowl back, that tends to have created a cycle in stock markets. So generally, those types of cycles last for a few years, but because of the period of extraordinary monetary policy that we have seen for the last decade, this cyclical bull market has gone on much longer than anyone would have countenanced back in 2008 and 2009, or even 2010. And it opens up a big question, because just how much of a dislocation or a misallocation of capital has occurred during this decade, where everything has gone up, everything from stocks to bonds to property and to the art market has gone higher. There was another antique car auction in Scottsdale over the last couple of days, and again, record sums being paid for old cars. And I don't know that, I mean, I'm not the biggest aficionado of automobiles, but I don't remember these kinds of auctions making headlines 10 years ago. And these are a reasonably new phenomenon, and the quantity of money that is flowing around the market is still very high indeed. So when we start to think in those terms, then we know that there is a lot of money outstanding. And margin debt is not updated particularly frequently. But when we look at it, we can see clearly that we are in a rather odd situation at present, because every time it got up to a peak before, it pulled back, and it pulled back sharply. And it could have pulled back sharply in 2015, and then it didn't. It went on to new all-time highs, and this was last updated in November, or really at the end of November. And considering how much markets have gone up since then, well, we can anticipate that margin debt is at another new high in here right now. So what that tells us is that there is plenty of leverage in the system. The fact that volatility is so low tells us that there is plenty of leverage in the system. And that also it is symptomatic of the market condition that we would expect when markets are accelerating higher. Markets don't accelerate higher because there's no new money coming in. It's because it is an acceleration in the money that's coming into the market. So one question has to be is where is all of this additional money coming from if we have in fact got an environment where the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates three times and they're beginning to normalize the size of their balance sheet. But when we think about just how quickly that's going to happen, well, so far it has been at a snail's pace. So people are putting money to work in the market at an accelerating rate, and that is transforming the valuations of stocks. So we're seeing the major mega caps going higher, and they are dragging their indices higher. What we also have to pay attention to is that there are shares that were among the early leaders and are no longer going up. So that is a large downside key reversal on Starbucks this week, and it has been ranging already for over 2 years. Disney has also been ranging for a prolonged period of time and has been engaged in numerous takeovers, so that might at least be rationalized. Nike has been going sideways for a prolonged period, but it did break out to new high ground this week. So when we look at these types of shares, well, Starbucks still has to demonstrate that it can hold this range. But so far, a number of these other shares that have been in hiatus mode for 2 years already do appear to be firming up in here. And again, that is, I think, supportive of the view that we're still in a very liquidity-rich environment. At some stage, when that liquidity becomes a headwind, well, then we're going to have a bear market. But we're not going to have a bear market, I think, at least until we see high yield spreads breaking out in a dynamic manner. And there is no sign of that yet. So, one of the things that primarily people in the bond market who tend to have more of a bearish view generally, they are pointing out some of the evolving problems and the overvaluations and some of the irrationality that is coming through in the activity that leads up to accelerations. But so far, this is the beginning of the acceleration and the third psychological perception stage of a major bull market, which is characterized by acceleration, can be lengthy. And that suggests that, and we also have to realize that what is in fact happening is that investors are still pricing in the bonus that they're going to receive from tax cuts in the USA. That a lot of people, particularly in the lower to middle income levels, are going to receive a significant tax cut. Corporations are going to receive a significant tax cut, and a significant number of those corporations are going to be bringing money back from overseas. And well, the economy is already at full employment, so they're either going to have to raise wages, which would be a bonus for workers, or they're going to be giving that money back to shareholders, and they may do both. And again, that is really quite a bonus for stockholders. So that is at least part of the reason why we're seeing these stock market indices breaking higher. And it is the indices that are breaking higher and being led higher by the large cap shares, not least because of ETF investing, which, as I've said before, is earnings agnostic. Just like risk parity is earnings agnostic, just like shorting the VIX is earnings agnostic. And the growth of earnings agnostic views, in other words, the growth of momentum, is characteristic of the third psychological perception stage of a major medium-term bull market. When it eventually pops, then we're going to have a recession. There's going to be a bear market. And then people are going to be asking, well, are the points that have been, I think, lauded over the course of the last decade still true? Then the big question is, how much has all of this extraordinary monetary policy contributed to the bull market, and how much of it has been from the secular trends? Well, the secular trends are pretty easy to identify. That when we look around the world at the major population centers, then what we're presented with is improving governance. India has got improving governance. Now, I would be the first to admit that that governance is coming off a very low base, but it is improving. And as long as it is improving, then the trend is likely to be higher. I think almost more important than the stock market trending higher is the fact that the rupee has stabilized. If the rupee is no longer among the weakest currencies in the world, which we can, I think, begin to argue when you look at that long-term trend from the early 1980s, that it went from a low below, excuse me, a high below 10 to a low near 70, that this has been an incredible devaluation for the rupee over a secular period of time. If the rupee simply stabilizes in a manner similar, just similar to what we saw between 2003 and approximately 2012, then that leaves significant room for additional upside in the stock market, because global investors like to have the stock market, the yield, and the bond markets on their side. And if they can capture currency market appreciation, yield and stock market appreciation all in the one go, then that is when big institutional investors turn up in a market. That's exactly what happened in Brazil at the dawn of the commodity bull market, when the real was strengthening from very depressed levels and commodities were taking off, so that international investors were able to pick up the yield, the currency, and the stock market appreciation. And I think that is now what is also happening in India. Now, when we look at what's going on in Hong Kong, then Hong Kong is a boom and bust market. And I think that has pretty much always been the case. And it is now breaking on the upside. And it was up 500 points again in here today. And this is a trend that has tacked on the better part of 5,000 points in just the last 2 months, and it is clearly accelerating. It is being led higher by Tencent, which again is a technology company that is a major market cap and now the largest share in the index, larger than HSBC. And HSBC is coming back up towards the upper side of its base. It has also been rallying in a dynamic manner since the middle of 2016. So when we start to look at what's going on, then there isn't much that isn't still either in an uptrend or at least going sideways. And the things that are going down for really quite specific reasons. And GE would be a clear example of that. It's going down for rather specific reasons. And even there is really quite a pronounced short-term oversold condition. So it is due a bounce in here. Now, when I don't want to be too rambly, I want to try and draw some of these points together. So we are in a secular bull market because we have the rise of the global consumer, and most particularly in the major population centers. And China is authoritarian, and China is clamping down on individual freedoms. But China has also succeeded in developing a consumer economy out of nowhere in less than a decade. And that is an unbelievably impressive achievement. I think that the creation of the very fact that China has been able to create customer service out of nowhere is really quite astounding. And it's something that just stands out to anyone who'd been to China at any time in the last 40 years, and then within the last 18 months. So I think that that is really quite a profound changeover. And what we're starting to see is that it is being transformative for the stock market too. And the pace of the CSI 300, 300's advance has been picking up. It had a relatively modest pullback, and now it is advancing. There was, I think, a lot of people were worried about the property market in China, and I have to say that I think that eventually the property price in China will start to come down. But with the Shanghai Property Index breaking up in such a dynamic manner, the chances are that these kinds of problems are going to be delayed. And I think that that is perhaps one of the most important points, that we are in a powerful bull market where we have largely synchronized global economic expansion. And the reality is that synchronized global economic expansion papers over a lot of cracks. So when we think about all of the challenges that are outstanding for bad loans in China, or for the lack of governance improvement in significant parts of Asia, well, those problems are unlikely to come to the fore until we come to the end of this particular cycle, and we're just not there yet. There is just no evidence that we're entering a period where we could anticipate a recession. But we will eventually, and when we do, I think it will be quite clear that we'll start to see unemployment starting to rise, and we'll start to see that some of the factors like the There's a trend higher, for example, in auto loan delinquencies in the USA, but it is not yet at critical proportions. And in the meantime, these are accelerating markets, and we should really be just welcoming that this is the blow-off phase. So this is not a time to be selling up and heading for the hills, because we simply do not know by how much the market is going to accelerate. And I think that is perhaps the important differentiator between when we really examine charts and when we look at people that tend to have a bearish perspective. Because when you can identify what the problems are and convince yourself that they are going to be crystallized imminently, then you get out too early. And the problem is that in the blow-off phase of a bull market, you can go up a lot. And I don't think anybody knows. In fact, I know that nobody knows how, by how much this market is going to accelerate. We do know what happened back in the late 1990s. The market had been trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner, and then it picked up. And then the pace of the advance moderated for the period between 1999 and, well, it was really the beginning of 1999 and towards the end. And then in the latter stages, it really went haywire. Well, when we look at this same chart on a logarithmic scale basis, then we can start to put the pace of this advance and the percentages achieved into perspective. Because in that period from 1998 to the peak in early 2000, the value of the Nasdaq 100 tripled. Well, the index only broke out to new all-time highs in 2016, and since then it has gone up about 40%. So, this index might be accelerating higher, but it is nowhere near the kinds of bubble proportions that we saw previously. That when we see these secular advances, that they can go on for decades. And there are three primary points or themes that are driving this secular advance. The first is the rise of the global consumer. We're going to have an additional 2 billion people on the planet and in the workforce in the next 20 years. And their consumption of just about everything is going to rise. So when we look at it in those terms, that's going to drive demand for not just for technology, but for absolutely everything. And that's a secular theme. There was massive investment in the commodity cycle all the way through the noughties. So what that suggests is that we're going to have a period where prices have gone sideways for a fair amount of time, and I think that's already been the case. But then we are also going to have the rising demand for consumer goods. We're going to have rising demand for technology. We're going to have rising demand for healthcare, and we're going to have rising demand for batteries and automation. So that's rising demand for absolutely everything. Then we have technological innovation, and when we look at the types of technological innovation that we have right now, well, these are there are I think key points that need to be understood, because what they do is not only are they bull markets in their own right, but what they do is contribute to growth elsewhere. So, for example, the rollout of 5G is a massive innovation. And the simple return to performance of a share like Cisco, which for all intents and purposes builds networks and is increasingly involved in the cloud, is I think a case in point. Now, another point, of course, is that they have adopted the subscription model. And any technology company that has adopted a subscription model in the last 4 or 5 years has rallied pretty spectacularly, because technology shares historically have been highly cyclical, and the introduction of a subscription model smooths out their revenue streams and creates these very easily modelable cash flows, which then get translated into higher valuations. Adobe was one of the first companies to do that, and then you have a whole slew of additionally and significantly large technology companies, everybody from Amazon to Netflix to Autodesk and Adobe have all adopted these subscription models. Even Microsoft adopted a subscription model. In fact, that was one of the first things they did when Steve Ballmer left, was roll out Microsoft 365. So these are contributing to this. This change in the business model has delivered upon these very consistent chart patterns. But the other point is that with the rise of the global consumer and rising demand for everything, you also have rising availability of everything. And that's an equally important point. So it isn't simply that you have technology that is being delivered, but that these products are being made available to absolutely everyone. Well, Cisco is doing well for the reasons that it has adopted the subscription model, and also because it's pioneering 5G. Qualcomm is another share that is pioneering 5G, and the share has is back on a recovery trajectory following what was one of the worst performing shares in 2015. Then, when we look at Illumina, well, Illumina produces the best genetic sequencers in the world, and they released a new form of architecture at the end of 2016 that they anticipate will allow sequencing companies to reduce the cost of genetic sequencing to $100, and it's approximately 1,000 today. So that will be an additional tenfold improvement in the cost of genetic sequencing. And then you have CRISPR. So CRISPR is comparatively new. In fact, it's only been around for about 3 years, and the intellectual property is not yet settled. But the reality is that it's being used in every biotechnology lab in the world. So we have 5G, which is going to massively enhance connectivity, and that's particularly important for the future of electric vehicles and the future of autonomous vehicles. So that's one whole stream. The fact that you have 5G is an enabling technology for lots of others. Then you have companies like Google and IBM that are pioneering artificial intelligence and quantum computing. So again, these are massively enabling technologies that the discoveries made in these particular sectors have got long tails and can affect innovation everywhere. Then, when we look at the pace of innovation that we're getting in genetics, both in terms of sequencing and editing, again, this has a very long tail because it massively reduces the cost and speeds up the way that we can edit genes. And what that is going to do is just simply accelerate the pace of innovation in biotechnology. So biotech remains on a recovery trajectory, and the pace of M&A activity continues. Now, we have to ask simple questions. Is anything that happens on the liquidity front going to change those points? And I really don't think that anything is going to change those points. Then, when we look at the energy sector, well, that's where the question is going to get a little muddy, because there is a great deal of debt that is outstanding in the energy sector, and a lot of the unconventional oil and gas drillers borrowed a lot of money to continue their drilling operations when oil prices were low, and we're starting to see some of their investors asking for a swifter pay down on some of that debt. But I think one of the important points about oil is that it tends to be very much confined to these long-term ranges that are punctuated by equally lengthy, or well, I think very impressive bull markets. And we've been through a phenomenal bull market, and now we're in a range. But I think one of the important points is that range could potentially be anywhere from $35 to $100, and we're currently around 60. Well, we're actually currently around 70. Because this long-term chart is only updated once a month, and that suggests that we are midway through the range, and we could be in a very lengthy, rangy environment for oil prices for the next decade. And what that's likely to contribute to is the delivery of innovations in consumption. It will also create an innovation in delivery. Because when you have prices that are unsustainably high from the perspective of expensive production, well, technological innovation means that they'll bring down the cost of production to a level that will be acceptable. So we're going to get some kind of innovation in the production of oil at some point over the next 15 years, and that will contribute to another bull market. But it will probably contribute to another bear market first. Because the reality is that a lot of countries have been paying significant quantities of their GDP overseas for decades, and that situation is no longer tenable when we consider the quantity of debt that remains outstanding. And one of the, I think, most important points is that secular bull markets last for half a lifetime. So most of us, if we're lucky, get to live through two. And the bull market that we've had in bonds has been going on since 1980, and I was still in short pants when it started. I remember when my grandmother used to buy us government savings certs, and by the time we cashed them in our teens, their compound interest rate was in excess of 400%, because interest rates had been so high when they were bought. Well, my children will never understand that because they simply are growing up in an age when interest rates have been particularly low. They're probably going to have a pretty big headache when they want to take out a mortgage and interest rates are significantly higher. Because if we simply look at the consistency of the trend, the pace of the advance has moderated. This is a trend that is losing consistency and it has developing type 3 top formation characteristics. Well, if that's indeed the case, if this is a developing top formation, then the chances are that we are going to see Treasury yields breaking up and out of its current range at some point over the course of the next few years. And so far, this break above 2.6% has been sustained. So I've got a long in the 10-year Treasury, and if I don't see a reversal on Monday, I'll be closing it out. But I think that we do have a short-term oversold condition in the Treasury future. So we do have potential for a pause. But if stock markets continue to rally, we know that stock markets are also among the best hedges against inflation because companies get their pricing power back. And I posted a chart during the week of the fact that we are seeing companies raising prices faster than input prices. So they are taking advantage of this more ebullient environment to raise prices. You had Kuroda from Japan talking today that they are on the cusp of meeting their 2% inflation target. And I think that that is very noteworthy that you have the Nikkei that has broken successfully above 20,000. Now, it is overbought in the short term, but it has broken out to new recovery highs for the first time in decades. And that's, I think, a very important characteristic because if we're starting to see inflation coming back, then it could be profoundly a profound catalyst for Japan. And that would suggest that Japan is going to be a buy on the dips for the foreseeable future, because it is the country that has been trying to foment inflation longest. But when we think about these secular trends, they're not going to be derailed by the liquidity challenges that are represented by the fact that we've gone through this extraordinary process where valuations have increased, and that the potential is that when we do start to see the very bullish environment in tandem with synchronized global economic expansion, coupled with deficit spending in the USA, when that is eventually priced in, then these accelerations will roll over, and we are going to have a pullback. And that pullback could be violent, and it could potentially be something in tandem with 1987, considering that is quite similar to the kind of environment that we have right now. But we have not seen the kind of acceleration in prices that we had before the 1987 crash. And the bigger the acceleration, the more likely you're going to have a bigger pullback. The smaller the acceleration, well, then the less likely you're going to have a big pullback. So I think we have to be very careful to monitor the trends that are evolving, and then we have to be quite careful to pay particular attention to some of the credit conditions that are out there. One of the other big ratios that are worth monitoring is the yield curve, and it's been coming down already since 2011, but it's still at 53 basis points. And usually, this is a lead indicator. It isn't that specifically when it goes inverted that you tend to get the recession, but rather 6 to 18 months later. So we are still a long way from a recession by this measure. When we look at the Dow Gold ratio, there are 35 years between these peaks, and we are only 18 years from the last peak. What that suggests is that if this more than 100-year ratio is going to remain still a predictive tool, then we could have an additional 17 years on the upside for the Dow versus gold. But that doesn't mean that this trend won't be punctuated by occasional periods of outperformance for commodities. And gold would most particularly outperform probably during the next bear market, simply by virtue of not falling as much as the index. Now, the gold price is right at the upper side of an 18-month range, and it did race to get up here, so now we're getting some pause and consolidation. And the price has paused over the last 3 days, but as long as it holds the majority of the advance, and it did rally $100 from the middle of December, so it has room in which to consolidate. As long as that consolidation is relatively minor and not too dynamic, then the chances are that gold will break upwards. That we are still in a demand-dominated environment where we're seeing commodities returning to outperformance. And again, that is a late-stage phenomenon. It's usually when you get synchronized global economic expansion that commodities do best. And when synchronized global economic expansion rolls over, well, generally speaking, that's because some economy has gone into recession, and recession tends to be a bit catching, most particularly after accelerating trends. So when we start to look at all of these points together, we know that we are late in the medium-term cyclical cycle, but I think we're still early in the secular cycle. And what that suggests is that the next time we have a recession, it is going to create probably once in 20-year buying opportunities, because it's after the next recession, and once that has cleared through the global economy, then we start probably to see inflation coming back. Then we probably also start to see these secular themes reasserting themselves. And then that will drive us through to significant peaks with the odd hiccup here and there up to 2035. Now, that's a very long-term prognostication, and there's going to be, well, they say a week is a long time in politics, so we have to at least think that that is at best a guess. But when we think about what the length of a secular bull market is, then I think it's a reasonable prognostication. And that being the case, then we look on this blow-off that we're getting in stock markets as a buying opportunity, well, as an opportunity to make money. It is also a time to be most disciplined about our stops and about what we think is the I think to be most diligent about monitoring what we consider to be lead indicators. Because when those lead indicators eventually do start to flash, well, then we know that rather than having, I think, mental stops, then it probably is the time to have real stops and to avoid the temptation to buy everything back immediately after something has been stopped out. One thing we also know is that trends often lose consistency at their penultimate peak. And we definitely saw that kind of environment before. So, when, for example, back in 2008, we had a larger pullback. It was the largest pullback that anyone had seen in the context of this entire bull market from 2003 upwards. And the market went on to a new all-time high, which would have sucked everybody back in. And then it pulled back even more violently. So we had a much larger range before we got the breakdown. And then it encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. And then it started breaking down again. So this was a clearly defined downtrend at that stage. And even in 1987, the market had already been coming down for a few weeks before it crashed. So generally speaking, they don't all happen in one go, but rather that we do get signs that things are going awry, and then we need to recognize them for the kinds of signals that they are. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and on the weekend, I'll wish all the best to all of you.